Today is Friday, March 5th, and you are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. Senate gears up to vote on COVID relief bill.
The $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan is a key part of President Biden's domestic agenda.
Also, U.S. UN call for immediate ceasefire in Tigray.
The onus to prevent further atrocities and human suffering falls squarely on the Ethiopian government's shoulders.
Plus, Pope Francis arrives in Iraq. These stories and more are next. The U.S. Senate is expected to vote this weekend on a massive new round of coronavirus aid addressing the ongoing economic and health crisis caused by the pandemic. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more on the impact of that aid.
The $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan is a key part of President Biden's domestic agenda to maintain the U.S. as a global economic force.
It seems to be about as close as he can get to a full delivery on his promises with the campaign. He built his later portion of the campaign saying, we need to build back better, and he was honest in the fact that this is going to cost a lot of money to provide the relief to all the people that have been impacted financially.
But Senate Republicans argue the massive bill isn't targeted at the needs of the American people.
Democrats managed to allocate less than 9% of their massive bill to the entire health care response. And listen to this, even less than 1% of the $1.9 trillion to the vaccines that will actually finish the fight. They needed to save the other 91% of the borrowed money for a vast catalog of liberal spending.
The bill will provide $1,400 in direct payments to most Americans with lower to moderate incomes, as well as $20 billion in funding for a massive expansion of vaccinations around the country.
This country will have enough vaccine supply, I'll say it again, for every adult in America by the end of May.
One key provision will also extend $400 weekly federal unemployment benefits to jobless Americans. A popular part of the $2.2 trillion CARES Act, the largest aid package in U.S. history that lawmakers passed last year to shore up a cratering economy.
The money goes not only to personal bank accounts and to help them with their individual lives, but also in big, broad strokes at different levels of government and to directly to small businesses to help them get through the pandemic.
Cases of the coronavirus are at their lowest number in the U.S. since October, and some economists say the U.S. could return to pre-pandemic levels of employment by the middle of this year. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Security was tight on Thursday at the U.S. Capitol, scene of a deadly assault in January, after police warned that a militia group might try to attack it to mark a key date on the calendar of a baseless conspiracy theory. There were, however, no signs of protesters. For more, I spoke with VOA's congressional correspondent, Catherine Gibson.
It's a very different situation on Capitol Hill this time around because, of course, we know all of those reinforced security precautions have come through. There's a fence around the U.S. Capitol, barbed wire. There are National Guard troops this time. There's a lot more awareness that the U.S. Capitol is a target and that it indeed can be breached. So while there's a deep amount of concern, there is also a sense that authorities know the mistakes that were made on January 6th and are working to correct them.
What was it like today, especially since the House called off a session because of the security threats?
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was telling reporters on Capitol Hill that she didn't feel that they had called off the session today because of those security threats. She made it sound as though they had already planned to have a half day, which is the normal schedule in the U.S. House of Representatives on a Thursday. But look, we have to take a step back here and remember that for many conspiracy theorists in the United States, March 4th is a special day when they believe that former President Donald Trump will fully actually be inaugurated, because that is the old inauguration day in American history.
Did you get a sense that members now feel more comfortable with the layers of security at the Capitol?
Well, I think that one of the big elements of the security posture that has changed is the fact that members now have to go through metal detectors when they go onto the House floor to cast their votes. That is a significant change. There was always a sense in the time that I've been up on Capitol Hill that reporters, that members, they can move freely through the hallways, that this is the House where the legislating for the United States goes on, and that there needs to be that free flow of people and information. That certainly is not the sense now. There's certainly a sense of unease and a sense that really the U.S. Capitol should not be surrounded by a giant barbed wire fence, that that doesn't send the right message to the world about what's happening here in American democracy.
Has the shared experience of both the Democrats and the Republicans, especially during the siege, has that rubbed off lawmaking? Are they cooperating more, or everybody's just posturing along their own party lines?
You would think, or at least hope, that an experience of that magnitude would bring lawmakers together, given that everyone who works in the Capitol complex, me included, has a sense of respect for that building. They have a sense that when you walk in there, important things are happening that we are all a part of. Unfortunately, because of the way that riot played out, the politics, the ensuing impeachment trial of former President Trump, that was not the case, and that it very quickly divided, where Democrats were accusing Republicans of helping the rioters, of encouraging the murder of lawmakers. Republicans were accusing Democrats of politicizing this because they disliked President Trump. That feeling of solidarity was never really there and didn't really last.
That's VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson speaking with me in Washington. Protesters took to the streets around Myanmar a day after almost 40 people were killed by security forces in protests throughout the country. AP correspondent Karine Shamas reports.
Crowds gathered in Yangon, Myanmar's largest city, chanting against the recent coup and violence that has killed many protesters so far. Despite the shocking violence the day before, demonstrators across the country were again met with tear gas. Footage from the protests of Myanmar's bloodiest day so far showed security forces shooting a person at point-blank range and chasing down and savagely beating demonstrators. The United States called the images appalling. The UN human rights chief said it was time to end the military stranglehold over democracy in Myanmar. I'm Karen Chamas.
The United States strongly condemns the use of violence in Myanmar by security forces and is saddened by the death of demonstrators, State Department spokesman Ned Price said on Thursday. He added that Washington will take further action in response to the rising violence in the aftermath of the coup.
We continue to urge the Burmese military to exercise maximum restraint. This latest escalation in violence demonstrates the fact of the junta's complete disregard for their own people, for the people of Burma. It is unacceptable, and the world will continue to respond. The United States will continue to respond. We'll continue to respond in tandem with our partners and allies around the world.
State Department spokesman Ned Price. In a recent speech on U.S. foreign policy, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken said, quote, "We will encourage others to make key reforms, overturn bad laws, fight corruption, and stop unjust practices. We will incentivize democratic behavior," unquote. Discussing the role of the U.S. in the Middle East and North Africa, President Biden said he will conduct a values-based foreign policy. Sarah Leah Whitson, Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World, now explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Elshinawi what her group thinks a values-oriented foreign policy would look like for North Africa and Arab countries that are close to the U.S. but have bad human rights records.
Is quite clear. And the answer is clear both from the perspective of human rights law. So it's not just about our values, it's actually the law, but also from the perspective of what is actually in America's interest and what is actually in the interest of the peoples of the region. And to that end, I think the most important change that we need to see if we are to have a values-based policy, if we are to have a smart foreign policy that truly reflects America's interests, then we would stop providing military assistance and diplomatic protection to the abusive governments of the region. That it's very important to distinguish between what some people talk about, which is that the United States should fix everything that's wrong in the Middle East, should intervene to stop abusive governments from carrying out their abuses. I would advocate a much more humble approach, which is that the United States should simply stop providing military assistance and diplomatic protection to the abusive governments of the region.
What are the barriers to the U.S. taking a stronger approach to demanding democracy in Egypt when close strategic cooperation with the U.S. is in the balance?
I think that that is a false dichotomy that we see even very smart commentators often present. You know, that on the one hand, there's strategic cooperation and security interests, and on the other hand, there's human rights. And I think that's very wrong. Ending U.S. military support to Egypt, a dictatorship that is highly abusive, highly repressive, and highly dangerous, does not mean ending security cooperation with Egypt. Saying that we're not going to give them gifts of weapons doesn't mean that we're going to end all relationships with them. There may well be strategic counterterrorism cooperation, for example, that is in the interests of America and that is in the interests of Egypt, and that we might continue. That is a very different proposition from providing over $1 billion in military aid to this abusive government. That goes far beyond any kind of strategic cooperation.
How could the formation of Egypt Human Rights Caucus in the U.S. Congress help advance this cause when Egypt enjoys geostrategic advantage coupled with close security cooperation with the U.S.?
Well, I think the main way that it's going to be helpful, and we are going to be part of that effort, and we're very eager to see it move forward, is that we are going to force the U.S. Congress and force the Biden administration to reevaluate what interest exactly the military aid to Egypt provides, what exactly it serves. And I think it will help the American public and the American government to more clearly see how the Egyptian government's repression and abuse of its own citizens harms America's interests and violates its own human rights obligations not to assist in human rights abuses.
That's my colleague Mohamed El-Shenawy speaking with Sarah Leah Whitson, Executive Director of Democracy for the Arab World Now. Pope Francis has arrived in Iraq to urge the country's dwindling number of Christians to stay to help rebuild the country after years of war and persecution. On the eve of his four-day visit, the Pope said in a video message to the people of Iraq that he was coming as, quote, a pilgrim of peace in search of fraternity, unquote. Sabina Castelfranco reports from Rome.
It is the first trip by Pope Francis to a foreign country since the pandemic, and everyone on the papal plane has been vaccinated against COVID-19. It will be a challenge all the same, though, as cases in the country have surged, and there are fears that those hoping to see the Pope will forget the social distancing rules. The Vatican's ambassador to Iraq, Archbishop Mitya Leskovar, recently tested positive for COVID and is currently self-isolating, but the Pope has insisted on going ahead with the visit. In a video message to the Iraqi people, Francis told them how he longed to meet them, see their faces, and visit a land that is ancient and an extraordinary cradle of civilization. The Pope said he was coming to Iraq as a penitent pilgrim to implore forgiveness and reconciliation after years of war and terrorism. In his message, Francis added that he was coming to Iraq as a pilgrim of peace in search of fraternity, animated by the desire to pray together and to walk together, also with brothers and sisters of other religious traditions, in the land of Father Abraham, who unites Muslims, Jews, and Christians in one family. The Pope, who was forced to cancel the trip to Iraq last year, is hoping to bring new encouragement to the Christian community that was heavily persecuted during the Islamic State insurgency. The number of Christians in Iraq has significantly dropped to around 300,000. The Pope referred in his message to a martyred church that he will be honored to meet. He said there have been too many martyrs and that the Iraqi people still have in their eyes the images of destroyed houses and desecrated churches, and in their hearts, the wounds of broken hearts and abandoned homes. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
This is the Voice of America. Israel's defense minister says his country has a blueprint for strikes against Iranian targets if the country shows signs of nuclear escalation. One of the strongest earthquakes to hit the South Pacific in modern history triggered tsunami warnings across the ocean and forced thousands of people in New Zealand to evacuate. Small tsunami waves were seen, but little damage was apparent in the regions hours later. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Australia says losing, quote, one shipment, unquote, of the Oxford University AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine drug because of an export ban in Italy would not badly affect its mass inoculation program. Italy is the first European Union country to use the bloc's new regulations that allow exports to be stopped if a vaccine producer has failed to meet its obligations to the EU. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Italy's export ban affects 250,000 doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine that were purchased by Australia. Officials in Canberra say the move won't affect the pace of a nationwide vaccination rollout, but they do want the European Union to review the decision. Australia is caught up in tensions between the drug company and European nations over the supply of COVID-19 treatments. There are fears that Italy's ban could be the start of vaccine hoarding. Jane Halton is the head of the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovation.
Vaccine nationalism, in other words, one country making a decision to prioritise its needs over the vulnerable in other countries, is a very real risk. And that's what we're now starting to see play out here. And I certainly hope it doesn't become a global trend.
Italy has justified stopping the shipment by saying Australia, which has recorded a total of 29,000 COVID-19 cases, was considered not vulnerable at this point in the coronavirus pandemic. Australia's Chief Medical Officer Paul Kelly said the country was in an excellent place regarding the virus. Health authorities estimate there are fewer than 80 active coronavirus cases in Australia. The country of 25 million people recently began its mass vaccination program using the Pfizer-BioNTech drug. Australia has a key weapon against so-called vaccine nationalism. Domestic production of the AstraZeneca vaccine is expected to deliver 1 million doses each week by the end of the month. An earlier shipment of 300,000 imported doses of the AstraZeneca treatment allowed injections to begin in Australia Friday. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Both the United States and the United Nations are calling for an immediate end to the fighting in Ethiopia's Tigray region and for access to independent investigators amid reports of ongoing atrocities against civilians. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Ethiopian federal troops deployed by Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed have been fighting forces of the region's former ruling party, the Tigray People's Liberation Front. Thousands of people have been killed in the Tigray region, where hundreds of thousands were dependent on food aid before the conflict began, according to the UN. UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet stressed the urgent need for an objective investigation on the ground in Tigray, citing distressing reports of sexual and gender-based violence, extrajudicial killings, and lootings. The new U.S. ambassador to the UN agrees.
Be honest to prevent further atrocities and human suffering falls squarely on the Ethiopian government's shoulders. We urge the Ethiopian government to support an immediate end to the fighting in Tigray. And to that end, the prompt withdrawal of Eritrean forces and Amhara regional forces from Tigray are essential steps.
In a recent phone conversation with Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, Secretary of State Antony Blinken reiterated U.S. commitment to providing humanitarian assistance to the vulnerable in the country. Abiy made commitments to ensure security in the region and protect civilians, according to State Department spokesperson Ned Price.
I think what we're going to look to are both the right words, but of course, even more importantly, the follow-through.
Amnesty International has concluded that Eritrean soldiers killed hundreds of civilians in Ethiopia's ancient town of Aksum in November. Stopping the ongoing fighting and getting independent investigators into the area will require an international effort, experts tell VOA.
This is clearly going to take a UN Security Council type weight of diplomacy and political pressure to try to change Prime Minister Abiy's approach to both what is going on inside the country, but also to longer and badly needed reforms.
Akwe and other experts note that Ethiopia is a strategic U.S. military ally in the Horn of Africa, and in recent years has been viewed as a stable partner in a troubled region. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Leaders of the International Red Cross and Red Crescent societies warn the suffering of millions of Syrians is deepening as the country enters a second decade of brutal warfare with no political situation to the crisis in view. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Syrian civilians continue to suffer amid a multitude of crises, ongoing hostilities, gross human rights violations, a shattered economy, chronic hunger, and the COVID-19 pandemic. The International Committee of the Red Cross reports about 13 million people, or nearly three-quarters of Syria's population, now rely on international humanitarian aid for survival. This is a 20% increase over a year ago. ICRC President Peter Morrow says the population is subject to atrocities, many that breach international humanitarian law. These include disproportionate attacks in urban areas and the targeting of civilians and civilian services such as ambulances, water stations, and markets.
There are other conflict situations in the world where we see IHL violations and the civilian toll. But it is the level of destruction in Syria over the years that makes this extraordinary place. The flattened cities, the number of those displaced and disappearing.
President of the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, Khaled Boubati, lives in Damascus, where he witnesses the suffering of the Syrian people every day. He leads an organization of more than 13,000 volunteers and employees who he says suffer the same agony and miserable living conditions as everyone else. He says 65 of his volunteers have lost their lives while providing life-saving assistance to civilians in dire need. He says humanitarian action is severely hampered because of lack of money and international sanctions.
No food parcel or health care can be delivered. Sanctions also have an effect on importing medical equipment, suppliers, and medicine. The humanitarian process is stumbling due to the lack of the fuel needed for ambulance and aid trucks, power station, generator for hospital and the blood banks.
President of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, Francesco Rocca, says the immense humanitarian needs across Syria are being exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
New Zealand police said on Thursday they have arrested two people following a threat made against the mosques that were the scene of mass murder by white supremacists nearly 2 years ago. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
New Zealand police said on Thursday they have arrested two people following a threat against the mosques that were the scene of a mass murder in Christchurch 2 years ago. Police said an online threat was made earlier this week against the Al-Noor Mosque and the Linwood Islamic Centre, which was targeted by a white supremacist in 2019. The attack killed 51 people and was New Zealand's most deadly shooting.
That's Libby Hogan of Reuters. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofori in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a great weekend.